The following message is from Pastor Peter Cho of Emmanuel Community Church. More information about the ministry of Emmanuel Community Church can be found at emmanuelcommunity.org.
In January of 2007, a 39-year-old world-renowned violinist named Joshua Bell went busking at the L'Enfant Plaza metro station in Washington, D.C. If you're not familiar, busking is when a musician, typically an amateur musician, performs live in public spaces for entertainment, for tips. And so Joshua Bell wore a baseball cap, a long-sleeve t-shirt and jeans, kind of went incognito, and he pulled out his world-class Stradivarius violin. And in that metro station lobby, he played six classical pieces for nearly 45 minutes. Washington Post journalist Gene Weingarten wrote a famous article on this social experiment entitled Pearls Before Breakfast, where he wrote, "No one knew it, but the fiddler standing against a bare wall outside the metro was one of the finest classical musicians in the world, playing some of the most elegant music ever written on one of the most valuable violins ever made. His performance was arranged by the Washington Post as an experiment in context, perception, and priorities. In a banal setting, at an inconvenient time, would beauty transcend?" I love that last line, which the social experiment was seeking to answer. In a banal setting, at an inconvenient time, would beauty transcend? Well, what do you guys think happened? I'm sure some of you have heard this story. And nearly 1,100 people walked by him on that day. Do you know how many of those 1,100 people stopped to listen to him? They counted seven. Seven out of 1,100. I think many of us in this room are like, oh yeah, I would have stopped. I would have appreciated good art. But do you know how much money he made that day busking? He made $32.17. Ironically, Bell would be awarded the Avery Fisher Prize just a few short months after that experiment, and that's given to the best classical musician in America. And in this article, Weingarten goes on to explore how could this have happened? How could thousands gather in Boston's Symphony Hall 3 days earlier, standing room only, pay over $100 per ticket, and enjoy the beauty of this man's talent in utter awe and reverence? And yet in a subway station, 1,100 people will walk by without even acknowledging his existence or recognizing the beauty coming from his priceless violin. Weingarten interviews a few of those who were around that day, and a shoeshiner named Edna Souza, who was stationed nearby, said she felt that Bell was too loud. She says, "He was pretty good. It was the first time I didn't call the police." And the article concludes that so much of our perception of value is shaped by context, by expectations, by our attention, and it reveals how we can walk right past so much talent, so much beauty, because we're so distracted, we're so hurried, we're so consumed with our own needs, and we're surrounded by people who fail to see it as well, and so we don't notice. And I think it's so sad, isn't it? Even Bell expressed embarrassment after this experiment. In between his pieces, he felt this need to just play a few strokes of his violin to break the awkward silence, which is usually filled with just loud applause. But here's the thing. Joshua Bell's value as a musician did not change when he left the concert hall in Boston and entered the subway station in D.C. What changed was people's ability to recognize it. And I share this story because I think this translates on so many levels to our life experience, our lived experience in this broken world. We're unable to see beauty. We're unable to see the intrinsic value of the people around us, apart from how it's framed by the world's terms, or because we're too focused on ourselves to bother or to care. But what does God see? And what does God desire his people to see? How would his people be different? Holy, differentiated, set apart from this world in the way that they not just see the gift of life as given to them by their father and mother, which we talked about last week, but the beauty of life itself and the beauty of the lives around them. Today, we're going to look at one of the shortest and probably the most quickly dismissed Bible verse in all of Scripture, which happens to be the sixth commandment of the ten, the sixth word found in Exodus 20:13, which says, "Do not kill," or as many versions we read say, "You shall not murder. You shall not murder." You know, last Sunday, I said that to understand the Ten Commandments, we must remember who first heard it and when they heard it. God spoke these words to Israel at Mount Sinai after rescuing them from slavery in Egypt. And as they prepared to enter into the Promised Land, God called them to be holy, to be set apart by reflecting His love, His character. And they were to worship God faithfully and care for one another and become a distinct community, a covenant community that lived different from this broken world around them. And last week, we also looked at what happened in the Garden of Eden, how Adam and Eve wholly rejected God by eating of this forbidden fruit, and sin entered into the world, and the curse of sin befell all of creation, resulting in a complete fracturing, a breaking of mankind's relationship with God in a vertical sense, but also with one another in a horizontal sense, leaving generation upon generation of broken families and cycles of suffering that endure to this very day. And with this came death and destruction. And it doesn't take very long for this all to play out in very broken and depraved ways. In the very next chapter, after the fall, in Genesis 4, Adam and Eve, they bear two sons, Cain and Abel. Cain is a farmer who works the land, tills the soil, and Abel was a shepherd who kept flocks, and they both bring their respective offerings to the Lord. And for reasons that the text doesn't fully explain, God regards Abel's offering more favorably than Cain's. And this is all it takes. It sends Cain into this blind rage. He cannot control himself. So much so that he murders his own brother Abel in cold blood, and God is not pleased. After the fall, we see death arrive, not only natural death as a result of the curse, but unnatural death, even murder, as a result of these broken relationships. A broken relationship between God and man leads to broken relationships between man and woman. And here, even brother against brother. And what does God do? God brings judgment upon Cain, and he's driven from the ground that received his brother's blood, so that the work of his hands would never again bear fruit, banishing him as a restless wanderer. And this judgment is too much for Cain to bear, but God still shows him mercy and does not forsake him, and even in fact protects him. In the very first chapters of the Bible, we learn this, that God alone is the giver of life. Therefore, the life of another is not ours to take. We can show that. God alone is the giver of life. Therefore, the life of another is not ours to take. Now, this is a foundational truth that God reveals, beginning with the first murder in Genesis. This is where God begins after creating life, because this is how the curse of sin quickly reveals itself. So God comes to Cain, much in the same way that he approaches his parents, Adam and Eve, and he comes to them with a question. But this time, it's not, "Where are you?" The question for Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. This time, the question is for Cain is, "Where is your brother? Where is your brother Abel?" And Cain reveals his complete disdain for the sanctity of life by first lying to God. And he says, "I don't know. I don't know where my brother is." And then he responds to God's question with his own question. He says, "Am I my brother's keeper? Am I my brother's keeper?" And this is akin to saying, "Why is his well-being my responsibility, God? Why should I care what happens to him? Who is he to me?" This sin passes to Cain's descendants. And a few generations later, in the same chapter, we are introduced to Lamech, who boasts to his wives, "I have killed a man for wounding me, a young man for injuring me. If Cain is avenged 7 times, then Lamech 77 times." And this is the state of our fallen world, a world where humans do not want equal justice, if we're actually truthful. We want revenge. We want disproportionate revenge. The Mosaic Law speaks into these cycles of vengeance with this. It says an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, which we often think of that as, oh, okay, we were permitted to pay back someone who has hurt you. But actually, it's a word of restraint from disproportionate revenge for those who have harmed us, from responding like Lamech 77 times over. I want to pay you back. That sinfulness still echoes among all of us today, and like Cain, we ask the same questions, if not from our mouths, with our hearts. Am I my brother's keeper? Why should I care for another, especially if they've harmed me? Who are they to me? You know, as Pastor Steve explained in the second sermon in this series, you shall not make any graven image. One of the reasons why God forbids the making of images of himself is because he has already placed his image in us. From the very first chapter in the Bible, in the creation account, Genesis 1:27, it says, "So God created mankind in his own image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them." Every human being is created as God's image bearer. Therefore, human worth, human dignity is not based on what we accomplish, how useful we are, how productive we are, how intelligent we are, our physical abilities, our physical appearance, our age, our wealth, our ethnicity, our social standing. These are all the ways in which the world stratifies worth or assigns value to a person. But that is not how God operates. According to the only opinion that matters, God, our value is rooted in whose image we bear. Even if that image has been marred by sin, all of us hold a deep and intrinsic value because we are created by God in the image of God, and we are to honor one another on God's terms and not our own. This is affirmed by God again with Noah, even after the fall, and stated as a central reason why killing another person is inherently wrong. Genesis 9, 5 and 6, it says this, whoever sheds human blood, by humans shall their blood be shed. Why? For in the image of God has God made mankind. God prohibits the creation of graven images to worship because the unfathomable beauty and glory of God is never to be reduced into an image. And as a result, we are also not to reduce one another as anything less than image bearers of the living God. So God desires to form a people who honors life as his beloved image bearers. I think you might have to click to activate that slide. There we go. God desires to form a people who honor life as his beloved image bearers. As I mentioned earlier, that Stradivarius violin that Josh Bell played, it was incredibly valuable. It's incredibly famous. This iconic violin was created by Antonio Stradivari, 1713, when he was in the absolute height of his craft. And the tones that this violin produced cannot be replicated even today with modern science and technology. And Josh Bell, he purchased this instrument in 2001 for around $4 million, and it was known as the Huberman Strad, named after the famous Polish musician, Bronisław Huberman, who had this violin actually stolen from him twice, disappearing for nearly 50 years before it was recovered after Huberman died. And it was recovered because of a deathbed confession of the thief, who apparently was a very mediocre violinist himself, who saw the opportunity when it was in Carnegie Hall, you know, in the dressing room, and he just grabbed it. And though this violin has been stolen and mishandled, and it was hidden over many years, today most estimate that the value of this violin today is around $14 million. It's over three times what Josh Bell paid for it, and I think he still owns it. Why? Why is it so valuable? Because the value is not determined by what happened to it, who possessed it, or even the damage that it may have suffered. The value is rooted in who made this violin. In the same way, no matter how broken and how unlovable we may find others to be, no matter what you or I have been through, our value is not defined by us or by this world, but by the one who created us. Sin has marred the image of God in humanity. We've been broken by what others have done to us and what we have done to ourselves. But none of that erases the image of our Maker or the value that he has placed upon us. As Psalm 139 says, each of us are fearfully, wonderfully made by the God of the universe, and nothing can change that. Now, To be honest, it's kind of difficult to preach on this command because I think the overwhelming majority of the people in this world, and hopefully in this room, will never murder another human being, right? I was tempted to make that the question of the week, but if someone said yes, it would have been incredibly awkward, I'm sure. But what if we're missing something much bigger here, something far richer than, like those commuters in D.C. did in that metro station? Why would God put do not murder at the very heart of the Ten Commandments, these 10 words, if it's irrelevant to almost all of us? Well, in the very next chapter, in Exodus 21, God begins stretching the boundaries of how we are to see life and death and how to administer justice in these situations that go beyond our narrow definition of murder or killing. In Exodus 21, 28 through 32, it says this, if a bull gores a man or a woman to death, the bull is to be stoned to death, and its meat must not be eaten. But the owner of the bull will not be held responsible. If, however, the bull has the habit of goring, and the owner has been warned, but has not kept it penned up, and it kills a man or woman, the bull is to be stoned, and its owner also is to be put to death. However, if payment is demanded, the owner may redeem his life by the payment of whatever is demanded. Now, this is so interesting to me because as the Torah unfolds, the first five books of the Bible, the books of Moses, the Torah, we begin to see that God's concern for human life extends beyond just murder. God's people are also held responsible for negligence that puts other human lives at risk. Most popular English Bible translations, as I said earlier, translate the Hebrew word for murder here, pronounced ratzach, as murder. But I don't think the word murder does justice to the meaning because there isn't really an English word, I think, that captures the essence of this word. I think when most of us think of the word murder, what comes to mind is a premeditated act of violence where someone intentionally takes the life of another person. For the sake of time, I'm not going to go into detail here, but in Numbers 35... the book after Exodus, or two books after Exodus, Numbers 35, you see more examples in which ratzach is used, and it's describing both a murderer and also someone who has unintentionally killed another person. And this could be due to neglect, due to an accident, and what we often call manslaughter. It reveals God's deep concern, even for the unintentional taking of a human life, and invites God's people to treat every human life with great value, with great seriousness. And so as we continue in Exodus, we find that God calls his people to not only refrain from taking a life by saying, do not murder, but God builds on this by saying essentially, do not unnecessarily endanger life. Don't endanger life if it is in your power to do so. When I was in seminary, I remember in my hermeneutics class, which is biblical interpretation, we were doing this group study on this very obscure passage found in Deuteronomy 22:8, and it says this, when you build a new house, you shall make a parapet for your roof. And what a strange little command, right, in Deuteronomy. And it's crazy that we even have verses on building construction and architecture in the Bible. Do you know what a parapet is? It's a low wall or a railing that runs along the edge of a building, a flat roof, or a bridge, and its primary purpose is to protect people from falling off these elevated surfaces. And the next pic you can see, this is a parapet for a home in the North Shore of Israel. It's a nicer. Rooftops in the ancient Northeast were used a lot for a lot of different reasons, but one main reason was actually for social gatherings. So then you begin to understand why this verse is in the Bible. Because when you read the rest of the verse, you understand the instructions. This, when you build a new house, you shall make a parapet for your roof. Why? That you may not bring the guilt of blood upon your house if anyone should fall from it, should fall from the rooftop because you don't have a parapet. And I realized we actually don't have any parapets on any of the four buildings on our campus here. Which and I've been up there to see all the old HVAC units that we need to replace, and it's actually kind of scary when you get to the edge because all it takes is a stiff wind and you could fall off the roof. So ICC is in violation of God's command. But again, how do we apply this truth to us today? I think it's okay. We're not gathering and congregating on our roof, right? And so I think this verse doesn't apply to us to build a parapet on our roof. I hope not. We don't have the money for it right now. But when you see this, you begin to understand God's heart, and you see how these principles begin to translate into our time and our culture. These are case laws. And these case laws were never meant to address every possible situation or provide every exhaustive rule to Israel. But they gave his people concrete examples in the ancient Near East culture of how God's wisdom was to govern and to shape their everyday lives. So that when we read them today, we should be asking, what do these laws actually reveal about God's heart for me and for others? And how might the Spirit lead us to embody that same wisdom and that same care into this world? So in studying these other verses in Leviticus and Numbers and Deuteronomy, we see how these principles begin to actually build off of one another. It begins with do not murder, right? And then do not take a life, to do not unnecessarily endanger a life, which naturally grows into a more active posture of these case laws like the parapet, which means take reasonable steps to protect and preserve life. If you can, if it's in your power to do it, take those steps to protect and preserve life. They show us how to actively seek the good of our neighbor, revealing what love on a horizontal plane is to look like. To honor life is to love your neighbor. You hit that one more time. To honor life is to love your neighbor. As Jesus himself summarized it at the heart of commands in the 5 through 10, is what does it look like to love one another? And as you said last week, the pivot, the bridge is your father and mother, the ones who actually physically gave you life, who brought you into this world and nurtured your early existence. Honor them. This is the way we honor life. And then it pivots to everyone that we encounter from that day forward. How are we to honor life? Well, let's begin with just don't murder them, right? But the sixth commandment is not just a prohibition against taking life, but it's an invitation. It's an invitation to become a people who honor life in every way possible. And we demonstrate this most fully by loving our neighbor. You know, 1 Corinthians 13, I think, you know, the big chapter on love, everyone's familiar with in the New Testament. But I think if there is an Old Testament chapter that is that reminds me of 1 Corinthians 13, the chapter of love, it would be found in Leviticus 19. Leviticus 19, it's like you would never guess, right? But tucked in this list of obscure, difficult to understand Levitical laws are some of the most, I think, profound ways that we can actively pursue the good of another. The ways that we actually are able to express loving our neighbor. If you have time, please just read that chapter this week in light of 1 Corinthians 13. Because it shows us that in very tangible ways that love provides. It provides for the poor. It provides for the foreigner. By the way that you leave the margins, you don't glean everything. You leave things for others to pick up. That's the whole story of Ruth and Boaz. We also learn that love protects. It protects the vulnerable. It protects those whose lives are at risk. It protects the widows and the orphans, those who do not have a voice or an advocate. And love practices justice. It treats people honestly and fairly. It does not use scales that are inaccurate. Love reconciles. It refuses hatred. It refuses grudges. It refuses revenge. This is all in Leviticus 19 in the Old Testament. Love provides, love protects, love practices justice, love reconciles. And God summarizes all of this verse in verse 18. It says, love your neighbor as yourself. Did you know that was actually first quoted in Leviticus 19 in the Old Testament? Love your neighbor as yourself. In other words, loving your neighbor is not just about not hurting them. It's about actively using what God has given you. Your resources, your power, your influence, your choices, your relationships to seek their good. And Jesus takes the heart of Leviticus 19 even further in the Sermon on the Mount when he says in Matthew 5, 21 through 24, you have heard that it was said to the people long ago, you shall not murder. And anyone who murders will be subject to judgment. But I tell you that anyone who's angry with his brother or sister will be subject to judgment. Again, anyone who says to a brother or sister, raka, is answerable to the courts. And anyone who says, you fool, will be in danger of the fire of hell. Those are pretty serious words, aren't they? And then he concludes with this. He says, therefore, if you are offering your gift at the altar to God, and then remember that your brother or sister has something against you, leave your gift right there in front of the altar. First go and be reconciled to them, and then come and offer your gift. Now this is such a, I think, fascinating words by Jesus, who takes the sixth commandment, do not murder, do not kill, and he shows that this goes far deeper, far greater than the teachers of the law understood it. It's not just about not murdering someone. Jesus is asking, what is actually happening in your heart towards the people around you? Are you holding on to, are you harboring your anger? Have you written off someone as worthless? Have you cut them out of your life? Murder is really just the ultimate act. It's the final expression of devaluing another person's life. We take it. But contempt, when we say, this person's a fool, this raka, these words out of our mouth express contempt. And that is the first step in your heart towards murder. It's hate. It's hatred. And then Jesus does something very interesting as he does when he summarizes the 10 words, the 10 commandments, into two of the greatest commandments. He connects our relationship with God to our relationship with one another. If you come to worship God while your relationship with your brother or your sister is broken, he's saying, go in first to seek reconciliation with them. Fix the horizontal. Because you cannot separate loving God from loving other people who bear his image. You cannot separate loving God from loving the people who bear his image. This is why Jesus says the second commandment is like the first. Love your neighbor as yourself. And Cain, he takes his anger, right, towards his brother Abel, and he takes his life. And he asks, am I my brother's keeper? And then Jesus, in the gospel, reverses the curse of Cain. And he pulls those who are on that same path away through his wisdom and his words. You see, in Genesis, Cain sees God accept an offering of his brother. And he doesn't accept his offering. And this is what enrages him, to murder his brother. And in these very words in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus inverts that entire story, doesn't he? He flips it upside down, and he says, don't bring your offering to God. Don't bring your offering and seek favor in that offering from me if you have not first made peace with your brother. So remarkable. Instead of allowing anger and brokenness to move us toward death, Jesus calls us to move towards him, towards one another, to pursue reconciliation, peace, and life in his power. And Jesus did not just teach us this. He lived this. He would even die, forgiving those who mocked him and hurled insults at him. Living a very life, not just speaking these words of truth, but living the life where Jesus redefined who is our neighbor and how we are to love them. Jesus redefined it. You know, I think when you read these words, I think there's some very easy applications that flow out of even the words of Jesus here. And it begins with contempt, as I said earlier. And do I dehumanize people with my words? Raka is a term of derision. It's a term of contempt. How do we talk about people in our lives? Do we strip them of their humanity, the image of God, by the way we talk about them in their absence? Then this command is for you. And this whole idea of reconciliation, can I honor the God-given dignity even of someone who has harmed me and hurt me, who doesn't seek my good? Can I still seek their good? Can I still initiate peace with someone who has hurt me? And then you look at Jesus and he's so full of compassion. Do I see the people that no one else can see, the intrinsic value that they hold, apart from the world's definitions and the world's standards? Do I see those who are suffering and pushed to the margins, who cannot advocate, who do not have a voice? I mean, the whole parable of the Good Samaritan is to help people to see who is your neighbor actually. Oh, it's far more than you would think. It's the very people you despise. It is even the Samaritans who demonstrate a heart that even the Israelites were unable to demonstrate. Compassion. To see a broken man on the road and to help him. This was the shock and awe of that story. And this is the way Jesus lived his life. Shocking and awing people constantly, especially those who define people by their intrinsic value, by the world standards. The Pharisees said, oh no, he's dining with tax collectors. Oh no, he's touching the lepers. Oh no, he's dignifying the prostitutes and those who've been married over and over again, like the woman at the well. What an amazing model that we have of what it looks like to dignify life in the life of Jesus. And in his very death, he says, greater love has no one than this, than to give his life for his brothers. This is in the upper room. This is his last words. You see, in the heart of God, expressed in Jesus, his own son, he says, not just do not take a life. He says, how my love is expressed is in the giving of life, even the giving of my own life. Can we see people not through eyes of contempt, through eyes of disgust or disdain, or through eyes of vengeance, revenge, retribution? Can we see them as God sees them? And I want to close with where we started, which is at that metro station in D.C. in 2007. 1,100 people walked by Joshua Bell. No one really saw him for who he was. Seven people stopped to listen. But one person actually recognized who he was. And her name was Stacy Furukawa. Everyone else just saw this very ordinary street musician. But she saw something that no one else was able to see. So if you can play that video, you can see her standing there. There's one person like 10 feet away admiring what is in front of her. She says, this is one of those things that can only happen in D.C. And in the article that Weingarten wrote, he says this when he's interviewing Furukawa. She says, it was the most astonishing thing I've ever seen in Washington. Joshua Bell was standing there playing at rush hour, and people were not stopping. They weren't even looking. And some were flipping quarters at him. Quarters! I wouldn't do that to nobody. And I was thinking, oh my gosh, what kind of city do I live in that this could happen? And when it was over, Furukawa introduced herself to Bell, and she tossed in a $20 bill. That wasn't counted in the $30-some dollars because she recognized him. But it makes me wonder how many people we walk past every day without truly seeing them, truly seeing their worth. And what would happen? How would this world be flipped upside down? How would we as a people, God's covenant community, distinguish ourselves if we learn to see people the way that God sees them? Let's bow our heads in prayer and reflection. I'm going to invite the worship team up. You know, this is not an easy word, I know, for so many of us. I think we hear this command, do not kill, do not murder. And it's so easy to dismiss, isn't it? Now, this, I've kept these since I was a young boy, as that young rich ruler would say to Jesus. I'm good, what else you got, Jesus? But it's not quite that easy, is it? Because as we dig deeper into the Word of God, which reveals the heart of God, we're able to actually see our own hearts for what it truly is. The light of Jesus exposes the darkness within our own souls. And yet Jesus doesn't come full of judgment and anger. What's wrong with you? He comes with compassion, kindness, mercy, and grace. And he invites us to look deeper. And as we see his art, what can we say? What can we say but holy, holy, holy? There is no one like you. But in the same breath, we can pray, we want to be more like you. Help us by the power of your Spirit, by the power of the resurrection, by the power of the cross, in which you gave up your life as a ransom for those who rejected you and despised you. You scorned its shame, and you took up the cross on our behalf. You offered your life in a world where everyone wants to take life. And that's what they did. They took his life. They took Jesus' life. So unjustly. So violently. And he had every right, he had every power to stop it. And yet he walked down that road towards Calvary, the path of reconciliation between God and man, redemption, so that all of us can be not just made right with God, but with one another. And so in this time and in this place, let these words, as God designed them to be, loving words from a Father in heaven who desires to see you flourish and to be made and conformed into the likeness of his Son. Let those words fall upon you, minister to you. You are loved. God sees you. He created you. He made you for a purpose. Whether anyone else in this world can see it or not, he knows, he sees. And can we close and leave with a challenge today? Can I ask you, who is it in your life whose value that you have failed to see? Who you have dismissed as a fool, raka? Who you've pushed out of your life, treated as dead, as if they don't exist because of how they've hurt you or harmed you, or because of how they make you feel? Who is that person for you? Who is God asking you to love as your neighbor?